Hey, hello again, everyone, and welcome to the Daily Caller podcast, the Friday edition. It is Friday already. Oh, yes, thank God. It's even though it was a short week, it is Friday, and Fridays are always good. The 28th day of December. I am Derek Hunter. I am your host, and I appreciate you listening. Now, for those of you new to the program, Fridays are a little bit different. There's a video component that is on the Daily Caller website, and we usually have some kind of interview with somebody, generally who's hawking a book, because frankly, they're easier to get to come to the Daily Caller studios when somebody's got something to sell. Not always, but usually. This time, it being a holiday week, a shortened week between Christmas and New Year's, and everybody in Washington, D.C. being out of town, except for me and a couple of people who work on the video end, the Daily Caller, that was nearly impossible. So what we did, and what you'll hear in a few minutes, is we took clips from some of our best interviews over the past, I guess the show's been around 7 months or something like that. So there's Tucker Carlson, David Limbaugh, Ann Coulter, Ken Starr. Each one of them, about 10-minute clips. There's a bunch more, and it's very interesting. I picked what I thought were really good bits that were self-contained, even though they're particularly long. And that's why this show is particularly long if you're just looking at the time. Listen on double time. It goes by twice as fast. Or make it sound like I'm really, really high and listen to it on half speed. So we've got that coming up. And at the very end, the last interview is Michael Foley, who wrote the book Drinking with St. Nick. I put that in there because I have been drinking the Turtle Dove Martini with dangerous regularity. Every weekend since I had that interview with him, I loved it, and I've been making it at home. And I've never bought Frangelico before. I've probably never heard of Frangelico before if I really thought about it. But it was so damn good, I went out, and same with Amaretto. I'd heard of Amaretto, but I never had consumed any of it, and certainly never owned it. Now I got a bottle sitting on the kitchen counter, just out of the reach of the kids. Someday, kids, someday. So that's coming up. As has become the norm on Fridays, I usually do a bit of the news of the day before we get in there, because the interviews last anywhere from a half an hour to 45 minutes. This time, the compilation is already over an hour, so that isn't really a problem. I promised an hour show, and I've already delivered an hour-long show, which means, theoretically, I could start my weekend a day early, but there's stuff that goes on in the world, and I don't want to leave that hanging out there, so this show's going to be a little bit longer than an hour, and here we go. It's a couple of stories I want to update you on. The big controversy yesterday, the scolds at CNN talking about how can you, these military personnel who brought these Make America Great Again hats out to the president when he visited Ramstein Air Base in Germany. That's an outrage and should be banned, should be not allowed. How dare they do that? They were basically, it was CNN, essentially calling for these servicemen and women to be punished by the military. Well, we have a ruling. Military.com did some actual journalism, and they report that the U.S. Air Force, which is in charge of Ramstein, has decreed that no rules were violated whatsoever. They understand exactly what was going on, and it's exactly what I explained on the show yesterday. When you have a chance to meet the President of the United States, you're probably only going to get one chance at that. If you have something, memorabilia, whatever it is, in your personal collection that you want to get signed, you would be insane not to avail yourself of that opportunity. Done and done. That's essentially what the Air Force said. Quote, there is no rule against airmen bringing personal items to be signed by the President, the Air Force said in a statement. And there isn't, nor should there be. Now, if you're rocking your MAGA hat while on duty or in uniform, yeah, that could be a problem. I understand that the uniform means you're on duty or representing the military, even if you're not on duty. And as such, you've got to be very nonpartisan. But they weren't wearing those hats. They were holding those hats. That's an important difference. Plus, the President of the United States was there, and they had an opportunity to get their hats signed. And they did. Imagine the uproar if the president, somebody presents the president a hat, a military man. Will you sign this, Mr. President? And the president says, well, that's wholly inappropriate, and just pushes it away. Yeah, the same scolds on CNN would have absolutely soiled their suits over that. They're ready to be outraged no matter what the president does or says. It doesn't matter if they agree with it, if they've agreed with it in the past. They don't matter. It doesn't matter if the president changed his mind in the previous week. They had disagreed vehemently with the president's position. And now that he's changed his mind, they will vehemently disagree with the president's position. They're insane. There's really no other word for it. It's Trump derangement syndrome, or as I call it, Trump Tourette's. When they hear his name, they immediately go into just this side of a cursing fit. They freak out. They can't handle that he exists, because this is the problem with liberalism. It's not that they disagree with you. If you don't agree with them, it's that you exist wrong. There's no real way to correct existing wrong, except to completely capitulate to their will. And unless and until you do that, you're their enemy. Even if you're in uniform. It's funny, they were using the military as a sword to attack the president. Now they're attacking the military because too many of them liked the president. The military is beyond reproach. Unless they like Donald Trump, and then they are a problem and they need to be punished. It's absolutely disgusting. Also disgusting, this story is making the rounds now. It's finally getting some attention. It should have gotten attention the day it happened, but it doesn't fit the liberal media narrative, and it certainly doesn't help the Democrats in a time of a government shutdown. Just as an aside, isn't it weird that we are well into a government shutdown? We're now approaching a week at midnight tonight. It will be a week. How big of a non-story this is right now? Of course, I told you it would be a non-story because today is payday for government employees, even those furloughed as being non-essential personnel. They're getting their checks. They won't get the next one until the situation is solved. But the narrative of the mainstream media before this happened and Democrats was one of these innocent government employees right before Christmas. They won't know where their next check will be coming from. They all knew that they were going to get paid today, that they're absolutely fine until, you know, 2 weeks from now will be the first time that government employees start to feel any possibility of an impact from the government shutdown. 2 weeks from now. But that doesn't really sound, you can't really say, you know, just 2 weeks after Christmas, these people won't know where their new next check is coming from. It doesn't have the same emotional gut punch as right before Christmas. These people don't know where their next check is. They're buying gifts for their children, and now they're not going to be able to. Doesn't really have the same impact as, yeah, they're going to be good until January. They're not even going to notice anything until January. So the lie was advanced because lies that advance the liberal narrative are embraced, no matter what the liberal narrative is. Anyway, back to the reason for the shutdown is Democrats' refusal to spend $5 billion measly dollars, or less than half of what the federal government spends per day. It spends over $12 billion, on securing our southern border, on building a wall. They constantly talk about how this human tragedy going on down on the border. There was a story in Newsweek about the condition in the detention centers for these sweet, sweet, nourishing illegal aliens is just disgusting. Well, stopping them from coming in the country would prevent them from being held in detention centers while we check out whether or not they're lying to us about their need for asylum and all sorts of other claims that they make. But that isn't the Democrats' plan. So forget that. It just doesn't matter. Well, when something doesn't feed the liberal narrative that all illegal immigrants are just the best among us. By the way, there was an interview with the Tijuana mayor the other day where he said that it's costing Tijuana, the government, $28,000 a day to house and take care of and feed and treat and care for all these illegal immigrants stuck down there waiting to break into or appeal for asylum in the United States. I don't know how that could be. I thought that they were an economic boom. They had like a cloud of positive economic activity circling around them, like Pigpen in the old Peanuts cartoons had that stink lines around him, except with a whole bunch of illegal aliens, because they're the key, according to Democrats, to our economic prosperity. Our country is thriving right now because of the illegal alien. To hear Democrats tell the story, they do nothing but contribute to the economy and take nothing or expect nothing in return. Of course, we all know that was a lie, and we're seeing examples of it down on the border. Anyway, to this story, out in California, Officer Ronil Singh, 33 years old, was killed on Christmas Day, murdered on Christmas Day by an illegal alien, a known illegal alien out in California. It is, of course, California is a sanctuary state. Right now, there is a massive manhunt on for this killer. It was during a suspected drunk driving stop, and it didn't have to happen. Again, as with Kate Steinle, as with every other case we've heard about, all those angel moms and dads out there who have lost loved ones to an illegal alien, 100% of those people would be alive today if we had secured our southern border and we enforced our existing immigration laws. If we actually took care of them, if we prioritized Americans over illegal aliens. But Democrats can't do that, won't do that, A, because Donald Trump supports that, and they cannot be in league with Donald Trump on anything. And B, they have made racial politics the go-to arrow in their quiver. They are trying to appeal and monopolize the Hispanic vote. After a couple of decades of telling everybody you have to identify with somebody who looks like you, you can only be represented by someone who looks like you, except for, of course, Democrats. We can take care of you. Democrats can take care of you. That you should trust people who look like you. That there's something inherently bonding to being around someone who looks like you. We see it all the time. College campuses are literally reinstituting segregation, but this time in the name of tolerance, so that Indian students can live with Indian students, because those are the people they most feel comfortable around, thanks to years of conditioning by the Democratic Party. Hispanic students can only live or can choose to only live around Hispanic students because that would make them comfortable. What if there's a white person in there? I mean, everybody knows that white people are the worst. Black students, Martin Luther King Jr. is rolling over in his grave because they are making black-only dormitories on college campuses, which is the exact opposite of what he fought and gave his life for. But colleges are doing that. So the Democrats have created this situation. Like I say, the country is no longer a melting pot. We're a series of chafing dishes, and they're being manipulated around. The Democrats cram you into a chafing dish based on the color of your skin, based on your sexual orientation, based on every irrelevant factor about your existence, except for who you are as a person. They will divide you down to that and manipulate you through that, with that, by that. And it happens all the time. So they can't say we have to seal our southern border because they've determined and established and spent the last 5 years telling us that anything short of complete and total unfettered immigration at will, legal or not, is racist. That securing the southern border is racist. They've been calling Donald Trump racist for wanting to secure the southern border. So if they then said, well, all right, we'll be down with securing the southern border, they would in effect be calling themselves racist. They put politics ahead of the lives of Americans and politics ahead of common sense, which if you're a Democrat, it's not actually all that common. Well, Officer Ronil Singh met his death, his tragic death. He leaves behind a 5-month-old son and a wife. Horrible situation. Met him, his death, at the hands of Democratic Party politics. They'd rather have votes than people be safe. Because he would be alive today if we had a secure border and if we deported people who came into contact with police officers, who had a record, who committed felonies. Remember, California is a sanctuary state. While the name of the murderer is not yet known, there's a name floating around out there, but I haven't seen it confirmed anywhere except social media, and that's not good enough for me. But once the name is known, the police haven't released it yet for whatever reason, I suspect that we're going to find out that this guy had, this wasn't his first rodeo, that he had more than one run-in with authorities. You don't go from a normal, rational, calm, law-abiding human being to somebody who shoots a police officer dead, who gets into a shootout with a police officer and kills a police officer. That just doesn't happen. You have a history of it. And I guarantee you there will be a history of this guy throughout the California penal system. And there is a history in California of that penal system. Actually, hell, there's a law in California now that says that local jurisdictions cannot cooperate with Immigration and Customs Enforcement. But before that law was in place, there were policies in place in city after city up and down the coast that said, you cannot cooperate. You should not cooperate. We are a sanctuary state. We are a tolerant state. They tolerate anything and everything except for people who would like to see our borders enforced and our laws enforced, especially from those people who are elected to enforce our laws. But sadly, out in California, the people who are elected to enforce our laws are liberal Democrats who don't want to, and they're elected by liberal Democrats who don't want our laws enforced. It's a sad state of affairs, and now a police officer has lost his life to this policy. Yet again, another person who, the guy, Ranil Singh, Officer Singh, was an immigrant himself. He immigrated from Fiji. He loved being a police officer. English was his third or fifth language, I forget which. And he was taking classes. He wanted to get rid of his accent as best he could. He wanted to assimilate, and he wanted to be able to be heard and understood over the police radio. So he was taking classes. That is initiative. That is exactly what we should be welcoming in this country. People who are assertive, people who are driven, people who want to be here and want to become Americans, not hyphenated Americans. Not my story that I always hear and I always remember is, it's probably 5 years ago now. There was a guy who was a janitor in New Jersey, and he won some jackpot from one of those multi-state lotteries, Powerball or Mega Millions. It's 200 and some million, something like that. He'd been in the country since 1987, I believe it was. He was a janitor. At his press conference, where he, because some states require winners of lottery to be publicly known, other states allow anonymity. New Jersey does not. They mandate that they be publicly known, or maybe he chose to do a press conference. But at his press conference, in the 2010s, he needed an interpreter. He'd been in the country since 1987. He was a janitor. There's nothing wrong with being a janitor. But you don't get ahead in life without the ability to communicate with people. Officer Singh understood that. And he was doing his best to learn to speak as close to American English as possible. You're never going to get rid of it. You grow up your whole life someplace, you're going to have an accent forever. It never goes away unless you're Madonna, and then your American accent goes away about 20 minutes after you marry a British guy. And then that goes away when you get divorced. But normal, real human beings, it's just par for the course. But Officer Singh wanted to be an American so badly, and he loved being a police officer so much that he was willing to do anything to be the best, most effective police officer he possibly could. And now his life has been taken by an illegal alien. No business being in this country, but it's favored class, Democrats, helped enable this. I'm not saying they have blood on their hands, but if the circumstances were reversed, remember any school shooting you've ever heard of, how many Democrats were out there running around saying that the NRA and all its members have blood all over their hands. They are somehow responsible, more responsible, in fact, than the person who actually did it. So maybe we should say Democrats have blood on their hands, because these are their rules. And if they're going to force us to live by them, why shouldn't we return the favor? I will point out, the story is slowly, like I said, making the rounds and getting larger, especially since there's a manhunt. Although even I didn't hear about it until yesterday, fully 2 days after the horrible event. Let's just say that the media is much more effective at spreading stories far and wide quickly if those stories happen to conform with the liberal narrative. But some stories are just so tragic that despite the liberal media's desire for them not to be known, become known, thanks to social media and conservative outlets. And then the rest of the media sort of dragged, kicking and screaming along, eventually reports on it. I want to point out just one headline in the Chicago Sun-Times, because this is shoddy journalism and bad headline writing, and I hope by the time you hear this, they will have corrected it, just out of bad English sake. The headline in the Chicago Sun-Times piece is, quote, "Undocumented migrant illegally kills California officer born in Fiji, colon, police." Let that sink in for a second. Undocumented migrant illegally kills California police officer, or California officer born in Fiji, colon, police. Like it's a statement from the police. The headline implies, first of all, we're using migrant now. It's alien. They're illegal aliens. Can we not just use real language anymore? But to then say he illegally killed a California police officer born in Fiji implies that there's a legal way to kill a California police officer born in Fiji. There is not. Shoddy journalism, shoddy reporting, shoddy writing. I hope they'll change that. It just gives a dumb impression. Before we get to the interviews, there's one more thing I want to update you on. Remember the Tsarnaev brothers, Tamerlan and Dzhokhar Tsarnaev? Tamerlan was killed by Dzhokhar. He allegedly ran over him after they were trying to escape from police. Well, Dzhokhar, aside from appearing on the cover of Rolling Stone like he was a teenage dreamboat rock star, is rotting in prison awaiting his death sentence, which can't come fast enough. Well, now, of course, because lawyers are lawyers, according to Reuters, lawyers for Boston Marathon bomber Dzhokhar Tsarnaev on Thursday asked an appellate court to overturn his conviction and death penalty sentence for helping carry out the 2013 attack, which killed 3 people and wounded more than 260 more. Lawyers for Tsarnaev, 25, argued in a brief filed in the first U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals in Boston, said that lower court judges' refusal to move the case to another city not traumatized by the bombings deprived him of a fair trial. Now here's the key, the kicker. The next paragraph. The attorneys acknowledged that their client, then 19, carried out the attack along with his now deceased 26-year-old brother Tamerlan. But somehow he got a fair unfair trial by being convicted for doing what he admits that he did. But they argued the wall-to-wall media coverage of the bombings meant that nearly the entire jury pool was exposed to news about the attacks, which included, quote, heart-wrenching stories about the homicide victims, the wounded, and their families, end quote. Yes, somehow a guy who admits that he did this terrorist act didn't get a fair trial because the jury pool was tainted, although he was guilty of it and ultimately convicted of it. That seems to me the very definition of justice. Justice is meted out. The innocent are not convicted, and the guilty are convicted. To me, that is justice. And then the guilty are punished. Yet somehow they're arguing that because the jury pool was from Boston, and Boston was traumatized by this, that this guilty man, rightly convicted, is somehow got an unfair trial. They can't execute this SOB fast enough, to be perfectly honest with you. That he's still alive today is a testament to how screwed up our judicial system has become, to be perfectly honest with you. We need fair but swift justice. Nobody on death row should die of old age. Just make death row inmates, just leave it be where you slide the tray under the door and there's a handful of Vicodin, a bunch of razor blades, maybe some rope laying around their cell. Let's cut out the middleman and speed up this process for piles of human garbage like Jokhar Tsarnaev. He shouldn't, you know, Democrats are very concerned about our carbon footprint. We could reduce our carbon footprint significantly. Think of all the CO2 that this Tsarnaev pile of garbage is going to be exhaling over the rest of his life as he languishes for decades through appeal after appeal awaiting his death sentence. We could end all that now. I say we do that. We go green. If you want us to go green, liberals, let's start with death row. Then we'll see how serious you are about saving the planet. Anyway, that is all the time we have before we get into the interview segment. So this show is going to be about an hour and a half long. As always, you can email compliments and complaints, and I appreciate every email I get at Derek, D-E-R-E-K, at dailycaller.com. Thank you for telling a friend. Don't forget to subscribe. Spread the word. New Year, we'll be back on Monday. We're doing shows on New Year's Eve and New Year's Day. We don't take time off, unlike other people out there. We're trying to build something here, and we're doing it on our own with your help, and I appreciate the hell out of it. So we got Tucker and Coulter, David Limbaugh, Greg Jarrett, Ken Starr, and Michael Foley. That's just a tiny sample of the people we've had on the show, and we've got some great clips of them coming up. I appreciate you listening. Have a great weekend. We'll see you again on Monday. All righty. Hello again, everyone, and welcome to it, the Daily Daily Caller podcast for this, the 28th day of December 2018. I am Derek Hunter. I am your host, and I am, well, this is the video edition, so if you're watching this video form, you see that I have Trumpy Bear right here with me as our co-host. It's a bit of a different kind of show. We didn't bring anybody into the studio today because it is, well, it's a ghost town around Washington, D.C. You got the government shut down, so it's cannibalism outside. It's just unbelievable. You can't even find bottled water or powdered food to save your life. It's just pandemonium. Save yourselves, people. Buy guns. But no, it's everybody's on vacation, and this is the last video podcast of 2018. So we thought we'd look back at the video podcasts that we've done in 2018. Not all of them, because we did quite a few of them, but just a selection. If you're one of the guests we had in studio and you didn't make this cut, because I think there's only five or six of you, it's nothing personal. It's just that we didn't like you. No, just kidding. Anyway, we just picked some of the best to give you a flavor. There's a lot of new people listening to the show, and you think, well, what's going on? What? Give me a flavor. Give me a sense of what this podcast is about, and this will do that for you. So we go back into the archives, and we take pretty long clips, significant portions, but not nearly even half of them. So if you want to hear more from these people, you just go back through the archives, or you go to the YouTube channel for the Daily Caller, and you'll find the video edition of these. On the website, there'll be the audio edition of these, and we'll have ourselves a party, man. It's all good. And we start by having a party with the guy who co-founded this place, the guy who hired me. His name, Tucker Carlson. And no, don't ask him about the bow tie. He gets annoyed by that. It's been like 20 years. People need to get over the. Every time it's, oh, yeah, you know Tucker Carlson? Yeah, I do. What about that bow tie? Like, you mean the thing he gave up in 1998? Yeah, that thing. Even Trumpy Bear doesn't ask about the bow tie. So without any further ado, I give you our sit-down interview about the book Ship of Fools, which I believe sold at least 15 copies. I could be wrong about that. But I would put the smart money on the over in that bet. It's our sit-down interview with Tucker Carlson. Did the election of Donald Trump cause these people to go over the edge, or did they just get less good at hiding it? Were they always this kind of crazy?
Look, I'm not going to claim that Trump is some sort of intellectual. He's obviously not, and he's obviously not. I don't think Trump even fully understands why he got elected, if I'm being honest about it. But Trump's genius is in sniffing out bullshit. He can just smell it and calling people on it. And one thing about Trump that I do admire is that he's not afraid. He's really not afraid. It's like, well, I think that's wrong. He'll just say it. That quality, more than any other quality, is a real threat to people here, because if you have someone who's just going to like look and be like, well, wait a second, you took interest rates to zero and the middle class got poorer. How did that happen? If you ask dumb, sincere questions, not, they don't need to be sincere, just like the obvious question that nobody is asking. And like, hey, Mr. Fed Chairman, you said if we brought interest rates to zero that it would help the middle class, but actually they're shrinking. So like, what happened? Someone like that is legitimately dangerous. Trump's not dangerous because he's going to do a lot. He doesn't have control of his own executive branch. Like, he hasn't actually been able to do that much. But his unique power is calling other people out. And whoa, they're really afraid of him for that
reason.
Well,
they're not used to it. They haven't been.
No, because there's this polite agreement that, like, you wreck the world, I wreck the world, and we're not going to call each other on it.
Well, we're also getting rich.
Well, we're both getting richer. Right, exactly.
Let's talk about the couple of other people on here. Maxine Waters.
You're spinning me up, man.
Hillary Clinton. I know. I'm trying to sell some books. Go, not to, you know, it's selling. Go buy my book. Screw his book. The thesis of my book was essentially that the left needs to keep people in an emotional frenzy in order to stop them from thinking rationally. The Maxine Waters of the world. Go out there and find them and tell them you're not welcome in society anymore. The confrontation that they're doing. I think Democrats are playing a game of chicken because I do believe they want to keep people riled up before the election to motivate them to vote scared or afraid. But they're hoping that nobody turns completely violent and nobody gets killed before November because that could kneecap their electoral plans. But they're willing to walk right up to that line and dance over it sometimes, as we've seen. And now we've seen Hillary Clinton come out this week and say you simply cannot be civil to Republicans unless Democrats control Congress, because Democrats or Republicans only understand strength. What happened to the Democratic Party? When you first came to town in the 90s, the Democrats and Republicans,
80s.
The arguments were there's not much of a difference between the two parties. There were significant differences on a few key issues, but in general, they were all sort of pulling the rock in the same direction. Now they are not. The Democrats have gone from a party with a fringe to fringe. There is no Afghan left. It's just fringe.
They're not in control.
Their leaders are not trying to appeal to them to right the
ship. I got it. No, I got it.
They're trying to get out in front. What happened and where does it go? Does it end in violence?
Oh, gosh, I hope not.
I hope not, too, but that what I hope and what I think are two different things.
Because you get into a very familiar cycle, right? I mean, it's, you know, you can think of 50 examples from recent world history where people get in a cycle of violence and retribution, and it you know, it's impossible to control once that starts happening. So, obviously, that is the nightmare that we all fear. I think what's happening, right? I mean, there are a bunch of different things happening, and I think you got to a lot of them, but I think from a political perspective, the leaders of the Democratic Party probably don't seek a lot of the things that are happening within their own party. So there was this populist revolution aimed at the Republican Party, and the middle class took over the party, and Donald Trump showed up. And
there's populism on the left, too, with Bernie Sanders.
Well, that's
it
exactly. Well, no, it's not. So there are two strains in the Democratic Party. There's the populist economic strain, which I think has some valuable things to say, to be totally blunt about it. Bernie Sanders is a kook or whatever, but not all of Bernie Sanders' voters are kooks. A lot of them voted for Trump. The message was not so different. The middle class is shrinking. That's the message. That's a true message. The other strain is the tribal strain, and that's an absolute existential threat to the country. And it's what I argue against every night, and in return for arguing is, you're a racist. Really? I mean, I'm literally arguing against racism. But they are using racism and race resentment as an engine to power, you know, voter turnout. And it's scary. But I guess the bottom line I would say is that I think that Pelosi and Schumer and Steny Hoyer and all these kind of antique Democratic political leaders are looking on in horror because they know they're not controlling this. They don't want to impeach Trump. They don't want to scream at people in restaurants. They don't want to be screamed at in restaurants. They don't want race war, like all this crap that's happening.
But they won't say anything about it. There isn't a Democrat who said, don't do this.
Well, there are two things. One, they're being led from below. They know that all the energy in the party is with the young radicals. And that's a challenge to the rest of us to think about, why are young people so radical? I'm serious. Why are they so young? Well, because their economic prospects have totally disappeared. If you can't even get married at 25 because you don't have enough money, you know, why wouldn't you become radical? This happens in lots of countries. But the second thing that's happening is the reason that they won't say anything about it is because Democrats are party people. And this is the thing that Republicans and conservatives and libertarians and all those people forget. They're different. Liberals feel powerless as people. That's why they joined in the first place, so they could be part of something larger to compensate for their own feelings of powerlessness. I'm serious. You don't need to be Freud. It's very obvious. So their loyalty is to a party or group. The average Republican, like, votes Republican because, like, that's the closest to what I believe, but he's not loyal to the Republican Party. Are you joking? That's why they voted for Trump. Democrats, they may disagree with what their party's doing, but in the end, they're going to support the party. And that's why when conservatives are like, the liberal media, there's nothing liberal about the media. The media aren't liberal. They're Democrats. They're loyal to the party. If the Democratic Party invaded Belize, they would be for invading Belize. They're loyal little robots. They're lemmings. It's a mindless horde of sad, insecure, dumb people hoping to become powerful by glomming onto a bigger structure.
I think most Democrats...
Right?
I think most... No, not completely.
Yes!
I think that most people who vote Democrat in the country outside of the coasts don't pay attention, enough attention, to really know what their party is advocating for anymore. They vote Democrat because they're union households, their parents voted Democrat. That's always what they did. It's sort of a muscle reflex that they go into the voting booth and they find the D. That if they actually paid attention, if they watched Tucker Carlson Tonight, for example, all 80 million of them, I think they would never stop vomiting and never vote Democrat again if they actually saw what these people are doing.
Well, I mean, I think there has been this real... So you grew up outside Detroit in a heavily union
area. Yeah, my dad is UAW.
Exactly. And, like, your neighbors and childhood friends, they're voting for Trump. You haven't even told me that. I just know that. It's true. A lot of them who voted Democrats their whole lives are now voting Trump. And so the realignment is underway. That's a real thing. I'm just saying, what accounts for the emotional response that you see from, like, normal Democrats, some of my neighbors, good people, actually, but when they see Trump elected or Kavanaugh elected? I mean, I sat through two election nights where Barack Obama, for whom I actually had contempt, was elected president. I didn't cry. Not because I'm a tougher man, but because I didn't feel personally disempowered. That's the point. For Democrats, for liberals, politics is at the center of the world, of their universe, of their worldview. I'm not powerful unless my party, my people, my group has political power. That's not how conservatives feel. I'm not powerful if one of my kids is in trouble or I'm getting fired from my job. Do you know what I mean? Or I'm fighting with my wife. For them, they're seeing, you know, think globally, act locally. No Republican has ever said that because Republicans don't think globally. They think in terms of their family and their church and their job. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
So, like, you're watching these people pounding on the front door and it's like, okay, they're little lefty robots getting orders from George Soros. All true. But why are they doing that? They're doing it because they feel diminished personally by Brett Kavanaugh getting on the Supreme Court. That's, like, freaking insane.
If you've been living under a rock for the past 2 years, you haven't heard anything about this wild Russian conspiracy theory that the president of the United States sat down with Vladimir Putin and just divided the planet Earth between what we get and what he gets. And in exchange, Vladimir Putin used all the resources available to Mother Russia to influence and steal the election 2016 from history's greatest victim, Hillary Diane Rodham Clinton Jr. III. Well, of course, facts are a funny thing, and reality is a completely different story. It turns out, as you know by now, undoubtedly, that there's more than meets the eye when it comes to the so-called Russian conspiracy theory. So we had a nice long conversation in depth with the author of one of the biggest selling books of 2018, Greg Jarrett, who is Fox News legal analyst, legal correspondent, I believe, whatever he is. It's a more impressive title than what I have. He had the best selling book, The Russia Hoax. He sat right here where Trumpy Bear is. Well, okay, not on the desk, but next to where Trumpy Bear is. Although if Greg Jarrett was a very nice guy, if we'd asked him to sit on the desk, he might have done it. So without any further ado, here's Greg Jarrett.
He wins November 8th, 2016 against all the odds. I didn't think it was possible, but it turned out he was right. How soon after do they go into panic mode and go and try and, what Peter Strzok labeled, an insurance policy? How soon after that? If Trump loses, we don't hear about any of this, do we?
Right. No.
No?
No. I mean, if Trump loses, all of the wrongdoing, misconduct, and what I think is illegality on the part of people like, you know, James Comey and Peter Strzok, Lisa Page, Andrew McCabe, the list goes on and on. All of that would have been dead and buried.
Mm.
And they were counting on that, by the way. They assumed
were
that
they
Hillary
brazen?
Would,
were they absolutely
oh,
brazen?
Completely brazen. I mean, look at the text messages between right. Peter Strzok and Lisa Page. That is a powerful narrative of severe and pervasive bias that drove them to abuse their positions of power to subvert the rule of law and undermine the democratic process. They were trying to undo the election results and so destroy Trump.
How long after those election results does this really get rolling? Yeah, it started before that, but it wasn't a top priority. But after the election, how does it, who decides, what decides that this has to be priority number one? This is suddenly what was casual, ridiculous rumor mongering and the ability to spy on Carter Page and other campaign surrogates to this is important and we have
right.
to press forward on this.
Immediately. I mean, the Obama administration went into panic mode. Brennan, in particular, by virtue of his conduct, James Comey, realizing that his job was now at the precipice, he would likely be fired. There is nothing that will motivate people more than power forfeited. And that's really what drove these people. They feared that Donald Trump was going to, as promised, drain the swamp. They were the swamp, didn't want to be drained. So they did whatever they could. They twisted the facts, they contorted the law to clear Clinton and then set up Donald Trump to frame him for things he didn't do. And immediately after the election, it went into overdrive.
There was a story in the New York Times, October 30th or 31st, that mentioned the FBI was looking into contacts between the Trump campaign and Russian officials, nebulous Russian officials.
Right.
But it wasn't a national obsession. It wasn't something that had really gotten a lot of attention of journalists until January.
Mm-hmm.
President-elect Trump in Trump Tower has a meeting with the national security apparatus. James Comey is there.
Right.
He sticks around. He has a private one-on-one meeting that later we'll find out when it happens in the White House he's wildly uncomfortable with. But while he's president-elect, he thinks it's very important that he has to tell him about the dossier. Then miraculously, shortly thereafter, the story gets leaked that the president, it's so serious, the president was briefed on this.
Right.
And that sort of starts the public phase of this, doesn't it?
It does. The Washington Post had written a couple of columns before the election about collusion, but it never gained any traction, mostly because I think the Post, like everybody else, figured that Donald Trump could never win.
Right.
That meeting between Comey and Trump in January before inauguration was a setup. It was done as an excuse to then leak the information, likely through James Clapper.
Because once you tell the president, once it's deemed important enough to
right.
tell
then
the president
newsworthy.
About it, then it's newsworthy. Because CNN, as we found out, was looking for a news hook to begin to report
exactly.
on the dossier.
Exactly.
And then the dossier gets published by BuzzFeed, it gets referenced by CNN, and then eventually everybody publishes it, and it sort of snowballs from there.
It does.
Was there a way, in the Trump administration's handling of that, and it's a hectic time, I think they were caught off guard being elected.
And they thought it was silly.
They thought it was silly. But was there a way that they could have sort of let the air out of the tires early on in this? Is there mishandling in the PR aspect, do you think?
Yeah, maybe to some extent in the PR aspect of it. A full-throated statement, none of this ever happened that's in the dossier. The real critical error, if you have to point to one, and Trump will tell you this, is his appointment of Jeff Sessions, who has to rank as the most feckless, useless attorney general in modern history.
Why did he recuse himself? He didn't have to. It was sort of a gray area.
He was duped. He was duped by Obama holdovers in the Department of Justice. You know, first of all, he fumbled his confirmation hearing and really stepped in a big pile of it. But that notwithstanding, when he recuses himself, he cites the wrong federal regulation. You don't have to recuse yourself in a counterintelligence probe, only in a criminal case. At that point, it was a counterintelligence probe. So, you know, he totally messed up in recusing himself. But his betrayal of the president is really quite stunning, and Trump knows it, and is, you know, is understandably angry about it. Mm-hmm. When he swears in Jeff Sessions as the new attorney general in the Oval Office, the next morning, according to Sessions' testimony, he puts in motion the wheels to recuse himself. So think about it. He's standing there, and he's being sworn in, and he hasn't told the guy swearing him in that he's about to screw him right. over by recusing himself from what was shaping up to be an important case.
And Rod Rosenstein became Jeff Sessions' deputy on the recommendation of Jeff Sessions, right?
Yes, and you know, Sessions, I don't think, really knew Rosenstein and accepted the recommendation of somebody he trusted. And, you know, in Washington, you should never trust anybody. So, you know, those were two egregious errors. But look, you know, when you're sworn into office as the new president, I mean, you got to appoint 10,000 jobs.
Right.
You know, I mean, it's a huge, and it goes back to, I was recently reading a biography of Ron Chernow's great book on George Washington. And, you know, at the outset, he was just besieged by people who wanted jobs and so many jobs to fill in the brand new government called the United States of America. And it, so this has always been problematic. If you pick the wrong people for key positions, you can undermine your presidency.
Rod Rosenstein, though, you argue, should be the one who's recusing himself.
Oh, yes.
Why?
You can't be a prosecutor and a witness in the same case. It violates the Code of Professional Responsibility, and it violates two or three other rules and regulations at the Department of Justice and the Code of Federal Regulations. He is, since he authored the memo that recommended that Comey be fired, he's a witness in any potential obstruction charge. And yet he oversees the case. So, you know, in a way, I argue in the book, he's really, you know, not only prosecutor and witness, but he's kind of the judge and jury, too, because he gets to decide whether any action would be taken against Donald Trump.
As we've seen, it's kind of funny because the Mueller investigation, the media will tell you, and liberal activists, not that there's much of a difference, that there have been 26 indictments or 25 indictments, and that's serious charge. Russians charged, of course. They're never going to come face trial, but there is one company that was, of the three companies that were charged, that since a company isn't an individual, they had nobody to send, they hired a law firm.
Right.
This freaked out Mueller's team.
Oh, yeah, because he never thought he'd actually have to prosecute a case. It's easy to file an indictment,
right.
especially if you think you'll never have to present the evidence in court, which is what Mueller did. He didn't expect that it would actually be challenged, and he's struggling to make the case. But, you know, of the 20-some-odd charges filed, how many of them deal with collusion? Zero. Which only underscores that none of this had anything to do with the collusion authorization. All of these cases could have and should have been handled simply by the Department of Justice. And had Sessions not recused himself, there would have been no special counsel.
Next, we landed an exclusive interview with one of the shyest, most reserved political commentators in the world today. She is perhaps known best as the J.D. Salinger of the political commentary world. But for me, as a personal favor, because I have been friends with her for more than 15 years, the reluctant Ann Coulter finally opened up and submitted herself to an interview. Many of you may have come to the podcast through an interview I did recently with Ann, but that wasn't the first time Ann was on the show. That was over the phone. This was in studio. She came here. Producer Richie drooled over her. It was embarrassing, but she was very nice and gracious the entire time, and it was nice to get her outside. She's very shy and, like I said, shy and reserved, reluctant to give her opinions on anything, but after a little bit of coaxing, we were able to get her to open up and tell us what she really thinks for perhaps the first time. Here to talk about her book, Resistance is Futile, and everything Democrat, Republican, and media, and Donald Trump, it's the shy and reserved Ann Coulter.
What brought you to write, because your last book was In Trump We Trust,
uh-huh.
and there have been, following you on Twitter, knowing you for
It's been like 15 years
since you held the mic for me when I spoke at Smith College.
Yes, exactly. you have been...
That was a good speech.
It was. You were a huge Trump supporter, and then on social media, after he became president, you've gone through
fits. I have tweaked him.
You've gone through fits of,
this is ridiculous. I call it tough love.
Are you, is it good Trump now, or is it bad?
Well, speaking of which, this is the best book for him. This disposes of so many things he's being accused of like nobody else does. Very clearly, there is no better book for him, and yet I am clear-eyed about the man. I mean, I'd still write In Trump We Trust. He was at least saying the stuff.
But we aren't getting the wall.
Exactly.
And that is, that's your big thing.
Good point.
So is it good Trump
We're
or bad
We're not getting
Trump
troops
right
pulled home from Afghanistan either. And I'm terrified he's about to start a war with Iran. And he has that warmonger, John Bolton. I love John Bolton. But, you know, Trump ran on not being going to war constantly. He won in South Carolina after saying we were lied into the Iraq war. I wanted to shoot my TV for that. And yet, South Carolina, big military state, we're done with war.
So which,
bring the troops
home. Which ways
home
are the scales tilting right now? Good Trump, bad Trump?
Well, that's the point. I think this is a very useful book for the resistance if they would read it. I would be able to concentrate on Trump's flaws. But with as long as they are out there, right, they keep bringing me back.
Then tell me, Anne, what is it about Trump that is unique to driving the left crazy? Now, in 2008, we were told that John McCain was a monster and Sarah Palin was going to kill us all. In 2012, they took Melba Toast, Mitt Romney, and created
right
him, turned him into a superhero who can impose cancer on people and tied dogs to the roofs of cars. And now, again, they're both back in good graces of the
yeah
media. But it was nothing like Donald Trump. What is it unique to Donald Trump that causes these people to be this nuts, or is it just the next step in the crazy evolution of the left?
I think it's the gold fixtures.
The golden toilet?
I think
LeMay just sets him off.
Having grown up in Connecticut, so I've been following the tabloid and spy magazine attacks on Trump. For a certain class of New York elite, and I would probably prefer the furnishings in their homes than in Donald Trump's
right
home, I will admit. I get that.
You don't want to sleep in a bed that looks like Louis the 16th got beheaded in it?
They just... His tackiness offends them to the bone. The fact that he is an Aravist,
but five
that
years
is
prior
what is
running,
driving their hatred.
5 years prior to them running, and actually a year, well, until the 2012 when he started on the birther thing, he was their guy. He was a Democrat. They came and kissed the ring. They wanted his money. They invited him to their charity events. They invited him to their parties.
Some did.
They came to his parties.
I
like
doubt
Joe
he
and
was...
Mika did, definitely. And now suddenly he's Adolf Hitler to Morning Joe.
No, that's a different contrast. But you're asking, overall, I think the style setters in New York are offended by Donald Trump aesthetically. And no, he was never invited to Graydon Carter's home, I promise you. It was always just ick. He is just so icky. And it's one thing with somebody who has a morning TV show. Look, Mika and Joe are putting Al Sharpton on. They can take Donald Trump. But they just find him absolutely icky. And then they were utterly humiliated by the election. And also, oh, they loved Obama. They loved him so much. And I will grant them. I'm glad we don't have to run against Obama again. He's charming. He's charismatic. He looks good in a suit. He has that beautiful singing voice. He's funny. A lot of people, he has a natural talent. He's very funny. Can't stand his policies. He did use, you know, the IRS to target conservatives.
There's that. But it was a scandal for
I lost my health care and used the FBI, allowed, you know, Hillary, I guess, to use the FBI to go after political opponents, as we now know, in the deep state. But you have to admit he was charming. And to have Fred Astaire as your president and then have him replaced with Rodney Dangerfield, they're appalled. And they hate him so much. He also stands for the Rodney Dangerfield, you know, the middle America, the tackiness, everything they associate with ticky-tacky.
How can a billionaire who's lived his entire
exactly
life in New York
relate to a factory worker in Iowa.
No, exactly. When they attack Trump, they're attacking the factory worker. They're attacking.
I know they are, but how? What is that?
Still
connection?
Talking.
All right.
They're attacking the factory
You've
worker.
Been hitting me all show.
They're attacking the Walmart worker, but they can't really be called on it the way that was it. A Politico guy who made fun of the Trump supporters without the teeth this
right.
week.
Mark
okay.
Caputo, I
so
believe.
They can't be called on it because. You know, they'll say, come on, we're attacking a billionaire. He's president. We can go after him. But it is, they are attacking him because he represents the deplorables. And then they try to dress it up. It's too embarrassing to say, oh, we just find him tacky. So they invent this insane Russia conspiracy theory.
But how does, I get that Donald Trump is able to speak to the guy who works in the Walmart in Nebraska. How, what is it about the guy in Nebraska who works in a Walmart, you think, who looks at a billionaire, a guy who, you know, hasn't had to worry about meeting a bill in his entire life and thinks, this guy gets me. Why is that? Because Republicans have tried. Mitt Romney, nobody thought, that guy gets me.
Not
you
a
think,
chance.
Who put that mannequin in my
It way? Isn't. This is explained in Trump We Trust, which I highly recommend you also read. In fact, if you could send a copy to the president to remind him of his greatness. This is a mistake campaign consultants, and I think the Republican Party has always made, that what people want to vote for is someone like them. Like Christians, oh, they won't take a Mormon, or they won't take Trump because he's not a Christian. No, Christians, military. I don't think military guys care. Did you serve in the military?
Right.
What they want to know is, do you have our back? Will you protect us from the left? And Trump was obviously going to protect Christians, the military, the police from these lunatics on the left. That's why they liked him. I mean, I love when he prays with the Christians, especially the black ministers. I love that part, and I hope it's had some effect on him. But I don't think Christians want someone who's one of them. They want someone who doesn't hate them, who doesn't sneer at them, and who will protect them.
Let's talk about the Never Trumpers for a second.
My favorite.
I know you catch hell from them on social media. I imagine you're annoyed by them and what they write in their columns and everything.
I don't read their columns.
People like Bill Kristol has lost. Maybe you're friends with Bill. I don't know.
I've been careful. I don't know why, but I knew him. We were friendly. I've laughed when other people attacked him, but I haven't attacked him.
I don't want it to be about him in particular, but I'm using him as an example.
Let's use...
Of these people who, while Donald Trump is doing some of the very things they swear and have sworn for the last 20 years, are their ultimate goals as conservatives. They want these. They want a booming economy. They want regulations cut. They want taxes lowered. They want to lower corporate taxes. And Donald Trump
did
that
thing.
Yeah,
all the stuff I wish Trump hadn't done.
But Bill Kristol and his ilk, the Never Trumpers,
right.
They don't care. They are willing to seize on what MSNBC's
yes.
lead is. Oh, Stormy Daniels, we've got his lawyer.
Yes.
And they think somehow that matters. What is it about these Never Trumpers?
You're never...
Again, Donald Trump
right.
sets them off in
You're
a way
never,
that nobody else ever,
ever
has.
You're never, ever going to win them over, Mr. President. Please stop sucking up to them. No, Trump is, you know, wholeheartedly embracing the Mitch McConnell, Paul Ryan agenda. They're never going to like him.
Do you think that
Dance
the president
Dance with the
thinks,
one who brung you.
Do you think he thinks that he can win over some people in the media still?
I think
he's
certain
got favorable
of
press
his
in New York.
Son-in-law advisors do.
Next, we have somebody that I was very much looking forward to interviewing, but I also had, and I wouldn't say it's a negative opinion of him. I was definitely wrong about my opinion of him, but to put it gingerly, I expected this guest to be the type of guy who sleeps in pajamas, you know? The old Dick Van Dyke show, you go to bed in pajamas. I couldn't possibly answer the door. I'm in pajamas and I can't find my robe sort of mentality. I thought he would be uptight just because of the way he'd been perceived and portrayed in media. And that's on me. Just so you know, that most of that stuff is garbage, the way people are portrayed. It's a story. It's very rarely reality. I'm talking about Ken Starr, the special prosecutor in the Whitewater case that discovered the Monica Lewinsky scandal, and it just went on from there. It should be the Bill Clinton scandal, not Monica Lewinsky. I was intimidated by Ken Starr because I always thought the man was a very smart legal mind, and he is. And I've known a lot of sort of academics or met a lot of sort of academics who are really uptight. They lived up to the pajamas sleeping mentality and stereotype that I had of them in their mind. That's on me. Ken Starr blew me away. He was very engaging, very warm, very fun, off camera, very funny, laughed at my jokes, which sometimes were off color. And, you know, I kind of like to test the line a little bit. I found him to be really, really engaging, and I've really enjoyed meeting him. His book, Contempt, about his time as special counsel, was a huge bestseller, runaway bestseller, and the interview was a blast and very informative. Ladies and gentlemen, I give you Ken Starr.
So Linda Tripp was the executive assistant to Vince Foster. She was the last person in the White House complex that we know of to see him alive. So she was a witness who we had worked with in trying to get to the bottom of the death of Vincent Foster Jr. So then the years go by, and the phone rings, and on a Sunday night, I go into detail on this, she talks to my deputy, Jackie Bennett, a terrific prosecutor, won the most heralded and high achievement award in the Department of Justice. So this career prosecutor from the Public Integrity Section feels the call, and that's when we learned about the president's attempt, or his soon attempt, and his success at committing perjury and encouraging others to commit perjury.
That, you had to go back to the judges to get permission to go into this, did you not?
The attorney general did. See, here's the, yeah, that's another thing that gets lost in the Monica Lewinsky fog. So the information comes to us. We have the verification by virtue of our recording the conversation that's a real time between Monica's. We're not just listening to tapes. Mm. We've confirmed this at the Ritz-Carlton. In Pentagon City. And so we take that information to the Attorney General, and she determines, she sent over a very senior Justice Department prosecutor, terrific guy, I knew him, very strong reputation, integrity, career civil servant, and he reviews the evidence, he goes back to the Justice Department, she very promptly decides our mandate in the Independent Counsel's Office has to be expanded to include an investigation into whether Monica Lewinsky and others have committed perjury or other offenses in connection with the Paula Corbin Jones sexual harassment lawsuit.
Now, that's a giant bear trap and a sidewalk on a sunny day. Did you know you were going to step in that in the storm that would follow it? Or did you?
You don't know, Derek, but you sense, you know. I'm trying to get away to Pepperdine University to become the dean of the law school. So I need this like the proverbial hole in the head. But our focus was, here it is. We can't ignore it. Here is the President of the United States involved in criminal conduct. We were already of the view that it had been in the criminal conduct in Arkansas, and we couldn't prove it beyond a reasonable doubt. I want everyone to understand, and we tried to be prosecutors of integrity, you don't bring charges in the federal system unless you have concluded that you can prove the offense by admissible evidence, so where are your witnesses, where are your documents, beyond a reasonable doubt. And that's a great protection to the American people.
But I knew you had to know that you were going to catch hell. That you'd already dealt with Clinton pushback on Whitewater and Vince Foster and the other investigations. But this was going to a new level.
Yes.
Were you? Is there any way that you knew something was coming? But did you know it what it was? Because you had all the dogs of hell from the administration. He used his cabinet officials to go out and lie. James Carville unleashed, accusing you of being a pervert and just a sex obsessed. I don't know how you could prepare for that. What was that like, and how did your family deal with that?
Ironically, we were somewhat prepared. I analogize it, I love baseball, to being in the minor leagues. That is, we were attacked and vilified in Arkansas, I should say. I was attacked most directly. The governor of the state had been indicted. So what's the governor and his apparatus? I mean, he had a PR firm and all that, and lawyers going out on the courthouse steps. So the theme we were hearing in Little Rock, Arkansas, it's a Republican politicized investigation. All they're trying to do is to bring down the Clintons. Mm. So we'd already heard that. So I guess we had developed one layer of skin to get a little bit more thick skin. But no, I had not anticipated, and I don't think I could reasonably have anticipated the furor and the fury with which the president saw fit to wage war.
A lot of positions changed then. When Monica was first added, her attorney was critical of President Clinton at the time, and you thought, oh, maybe she's going to cooperate. What happened there? Why didn't she cooperate as much as she could have?
My theory, and only Monica can answer this, and I don't think she has. She blames me.
Right.
I made her life miserable, and I understand that perspective. I disagree with it, but that's her perspective. I think she was bound and determined to protect the president.
You think it was still, she was in love with him still at
There's
that time?
No question. Well, I can't say she was in love, but she did not want to bring with us a mixture of admiration, affection, and political affinity. She said this, I described this, this has not previously been described. I describe it in the book. Her hallway conversation with her mother at the Ritz-Carlton, I'm not, she used very foul language to make it very clear to her mom that she was not going to bring this president down. So I think she viewed the situation in apocalyptic terms, and she wanted to help save the president.
Are you surprised how well the Clintons landed on their feet after all the... You know more about their dirty dealings than probably anybody except for people they were involved with. Now, right after 2000, she gets elected to the Senate. She's a front runner for the presidential nomination in 2008. Bill Clinton becomes sort of an elder statesman. All is sort of forgotten and swept under the rug. Are you surprised how quickly that happened?
No, I think the American people, first of all, are very forgiving. In fact, one of the things...
only when asked for it. We weren't asked.
No, it's a good point. But part of it, I think, really goes to Bill Clinton's personal qualities of being likable. It's very hard, I think, to overestimate the importance in politics, public life, of being likable. It's part of my free advice.
Someday I'll figure that out, but it's never been an issue for me.
You're doing great, Derek. But
I'm holding it in.
It's one of the things that I know we live in a very polarized time. That, and he hasn't asked me, but I tell him anyway, President Trump, be a little bit more likable. Quit picking so many dadgum fights. You don't need to do this. And I think he gets that advice probably every day, and he shuts it aside. So maybe he's right. But that's Bill's. If Bill, this was a great story about Bill Clinton, that if he goes into a crowded room, and everybody's his friend and supporter, but he sees three non-friends over in a corner, he heads to them. He has great confidence in his ability to win people over, which I think is what doomed him in when it came to the rule of law and telling the truth. I think he had so much confidence in his communication skills, and they are great, they are legendary,
yes,
that he could, in fact, get away with perjury and obstruction of justice.
Let me ask you about the attacks on you. Did any of them sting? You couldn't really come out and refute them, rebut them, answer them. You couldn't get into an argument with the President of the United States or any of his flying monkey army or anything like that. But being hammered and forced to be silent had to be a massive weight.
I was doing everything I could through the pillars of faith, family, and friends to stay strong because I had the servant leadership responsibility for my colleagues to try to be an example of them to gut it out. But there's a poignant moment that I capture in the book about our very dear friend, our pastor at our church in Northern Virginia at the time, gives a sermon about the loss of reputation. It wasn't directed at me, but as he was speaking, I was thinking, you know, Vince Foster gave this very poignant speech just 2 months before he took his life, a commencement speech at his alma mater in Fayetteville, saying, don't lose your reputation. It's the most precious thing. And then he took his life. So I'm thinking Vince Foster and, loss of reputation. And then I'm saying goodbye to Lon, our pastor, at the end. He said, Ken, I was talking about you. I thought, oh, great, loss of reputation. So that was a downer moment, but I tried to... and it's just the way I am. I try to walk on the sunny side of the street and to just stay focused, try to, and I wouldn't come home. Geraldo is now a different Geraldo, but then Geraldo was one of the echo chambers. Anything the Clinton folks wanted, Geraldo would, and he was really pretty nasty. And people would say, did you see what Geraldo did? And my answer was, No, and I don't want to. But I knew things had gotten bad when someone came in, I recount this contempt. Hey, Ken, and I had an open door policy maybe I shouldn't have, especially in this particular episode. Ken, guess what? The polls are out. Your numbers are below those of Saddam Hussein. So I knew the Clinton spin cycle and machine was really powerful and very effective.
If you had it to do over again, would you do it?
Yeah.
Putting aside the pursuit of justice.
Yeah.
Knowing everything you went through.
Yes, I would do it because I was asked to do it, and I've never turned down an assignment. And by the way, I should say, I was very privileged and blessed to have some assignments I didn't deserve. So it was time that I took
a hell of a penance.
Yeah, okay, good. I've done my penance. I hope higher authority hears that. But I would be a lot smarter now, needless to say. Having been through all this, I would have hired a press person much earlier. Mm. I resisted doing that. That was not a wise move.
You weren't a prosecutor. You weren't in the business of PR. You were going where the facts made you, and you didn't. Was that a sign of you just didn't really realize what you were up against? That you were resistant to a press?
It was a conception of the job, and the desire to do the job as quickly, as efficiently, and frankly, as inexpensively as possible. So I resisted add-ons and so forth.
Our next guest has a very familiar last name to you. He's probably the more famous brother when you really get down to it. Then again, maybe not. His name is David Limbaugh. His brother, Rusty, or am I pronouncing that wrong? I think I'm pronouncing that wrong. Rush Limbaugh, of course, brother. You would think, well, being Rush Limbaugh's brother, you can dine out on that all day long. Maybe you could, maybe you couldn't. I don't know. But David Limbaugh stepped into his own right in his writings more than 20 years ago. He's written multiple best-selling books, widely syndicated columnist, and just a really good guy. Personal aside, when it came time, when I was a publisher reached out to me to see if I had any book ideas, saying that they'd be interested in it. I had no idea how to deal with this. I didn't have a literary agent or anything like that. Nobody was sucking 15% off of me, but I thought, geez, do I have to get a literary agent so I don't get screwed over? What should I do? I reached out to my friend David Limbaugh. He's a very successful lawyer in addition to being a writer. He voluntarily said, I'll look at the contract. I'll take a look at it. He's been an author and a lawyer. He looked over it. He made suggestions, all free of charge, on his own time. Couldn't have been nicer. I didn't need to get a literary agent. He said, there's no point. You're just, what, are you going to give somebody 15% to do what you've already figured out and what you already have done? So thank you for that, David. He really is like he seems on Twitter and like he comes across in this interview. Speaking about his new book and a New York Times bestseller this year, Jesus is Risen, it's David Limbaugh.
So this, David, you are, you live in two worlds as a writer. You've written many books on Jesus and the Bible, and you seem to be going through the Bible and exploring it and translating it into terms that normal human beings can understand. Look, the Bible's a great book, but it's 2,000 years old. Even the King James translation is several hundred years old. Yeah. You read that, and it's not an easy read. But you're going through it and dissecting it in many ways. And then you have your political writings as well. How do you decide which one to go with? And which one do you like more?
You know, the first five books I wrote were political, and then I switched to the Christian-themed books.
Was it a conscious decision?
Yes.
That you're just not going to, are you not going to do political books anymore?
No. I'd written the two Obama books that did very well.
Yes.
And can I brag? I just did.
You just
they did very well. But I can see ask and get forgiveness later.
You're so hot.
But I can tell you how well they did if you want me to elaborate. But anyway, so we did those and political columns. I'm very passionate about politics to the point that I sometimes think it's my idol, to be honest. I mean, I'm so into it. Sometimes I wish, you know, because you're into your faith and then, you know, the world intervenes and you lose track and you go, man, I'm not reading the Bible much. I need to get back in. I need to pray more. So politics is relentless. Every day we're after it. And so sometimes you have to check yourself. But I don't think there's any inconsistency. I mean, there probably is in the way we approach things and our negativity in terms of how we feel about politics.
But which do you get a better sense of satisfaction? Look, there's something about convincing somebody politically.
Yeah.
There's a sense of satisfaction that comes with that. But it doesn't necessarily feed your soul like writing about religion does.
That's right. So I prefer, ultimately in the books, I prefer to write about Christianity because it's a respite from all this negativity that we encounter and that we feed. And this is really, as important as politics is, this is what matters most, Jesus Christ. And so telling people about Jesus Christ in the Bible, I feel like is a duty I have and something I want to share. Because when I go ahead, I'll leave.
Well, I want to talk about News of the Day with you later on, but I want to talk about the book.
So we can be hateful then.
Yes, exactly. So you got to be good, and then
we'll
do it in reverse.
Yeah.
Talk about Paul. Born Saul, born a Jew and a Roman citizen, who actually executed an apostle of Christ.
Yeah.
Then he has, why Paul? What was it about Paul that he traveled more than anybody, spread the word further than anybody? But
because the material demands it. What this book is a book about the book of Acts and six of Paul's epistles. I am going through the New Testament and writing these books. I did the Gospels first. This book is about, I was going to go as far as I could through the rest of the New Testament, and that's all I could do and keep within space limitations because I didn't want to artificially cram it all in, and it makes more sense. I can cover the material widely and deeply enough the way I did it. Paul is the chief figure in the book of Acts in the history of the early church.
He wrote about half the New Testament. So
yeah. Well, not quite, because the Gospels are four books. The New Testament's 27 books, and this covers seven. But they're very important books. Acts is the history of the early church, and six of Paul's epistles where he's writing to the churches that he planted in various places in the Roman Empire, Asia Minor, etc. And he's cajoling them, you guys are falling away from the faith. You're listening to false teachers. You're succumbing to these secular influences. And we have the same kind of stresses we have today, same kind of adversities, same kind of negative influences. In Corinth, hotbed of pagan sexual immorality and idolatry, the love goddess Aphrodite, and they were influencing the newfound Christians in the church. And Paul was writing them after he left them. I gave you the true gospel, and now you guys are deviating. Don't listen to the false teachers. Come back to the gospel. And it's so heartfelt and personal and real. I want people to get a history. Just like when I wrote the book about the gospels, I wanted them to feel the history. Christianity is grounded in history, the bodily resurrection of Jesus Christ, not just some abstract theory that some men concocted from the ground up. It's from the top down. God revealed himself to man. And so this book is about after Christ left, he was crucified, resurrected, and he ascended, and he left it with them. He said, I'm going to send my Holy Spirit to you. He's going to indwell all believers, and you will then be empowered to live more righteous lives and to spread the gospel.
Talk a little bit about Paul's journey to becoming a Christian. He was a Jew. He was a feared Jew. It was his job to go around and discipline other people who would blaspheme. He had the Stephen stoned to death. He oversaw that. He ordered his death. And on his deathbed, Stephen forgave Paul. And that's, well, I'll let you tell the story. You know it better than
I do. You're exactly right. Paul was, as he describes it, a Jew of Jews. He studied under the famous Rabbi Gamaliel. I don't know if I'm pronouncing that correctly. And
nobody knows. So it's
no,
okay.
he was.
It's been a while since it's pronounced.
Probably a different name in a different language, anyway. But he was. He was very observant and very adamant and very relentless in his pursuit of the Judaic law. And when the Christians were going around preaching Jesus resurrected, Jesus crucified and resurrected, Paul was offended because he didn't think it was just a competing religion, but a religion that was perverting and distorting the true religion of God. By the way, I believe Judaism was the true religion of God at the time. Mm-hmm. I just believe Christianity completed it. And that's where we part. But the Jews anticipated a political and military Messiah to deliver them from the authorities of the day, the Roman Empire, and they thought anybody that dies on a tree, that's hung on a tree, is a curse, because that's what the Old Testament said, Deuteronomy, I think. So Jesus comes along and doesn't even defend himself. He doesn't deliver anybody. He doesn't raise a hand to defend himself in his own trial. He's humiliated, and hung on a tree. So, I mean, he's crucified, in effect, hung on a tree, and accursed. So he can't be the Messiah. But in fact, what they didn't understand was he came to be a curse for us. He became sin for us, so that through faith in him, his perfect righteousness can be imputed to us for salvation purposes. When God sees us, he sees nothing but Jesus Christ. So for salvation purposes, we are perfectly righteous. But we're not really righteous in fact. We become indwelled with the Holy Spirit upon our acceptance of Christ, our faith in Christ, and then we begin to battle sin on a daily basis through the power of the Holy Spirit, and we become more righteous, more holy, more sanctified, as they say in the terminology. But Paul couldn't abide that, so he persecuted Christians all over Jerusalem. He sought permission from the authorities in Jerusalem to go to Damascus to round up these renegade Jews who had become Christian converts. And he wanted to bring them back and imprison them and punish them. And so on the way, he was confronted by Christ, the blinding light, and he was literally blinded for 3 days, and then taken into Damascus and was told by Christ that you're going to be my apostle to the Gentiles and you're going to spread the word. So from that point forward, after he got, well, he went to Arabia for 3 years or whatever, but and he learned the gospel directly from Christ, I believe, supernaturally. So when he went out after that, he was ready, and he went throughout the Roman Empire and established these churches. More than anyone else, he was a fierce evangelist, and he became, for the most, the greatest persecutor to the biggest one persecuted.
Yes.
Yeah.
Why do you think Paul? Because there were apostles who were still alive in Paul's time. Paul and Peter were together in Rome, killed almost together. Why would Jesus choose somebody like Paul over somebody he'd already chosen to be sort of the town crier of Christianity?
Well, and I don't mean to diminish the work of Peter and the other apostles, John, unbelievably profound stuff in the books they wrote in the Bible and the work they did. But Paul, I think, and not I think, this is what the Bible says, God chose Paul before the creation of the universe in his prescience, in his omniscience, to be his main evangelist to the Gentiles. Now, I think the reason he chose him, and I put this in the book, is because his personality and his intellect, he was such a real human being, such an emotional person, such a winsome person when he needed to be, but so strict and passionate about what he believed that he could convince people that what he was saying was the truth, and he had this boundless energy. And so when he approached unbelievers, he also had a very pragmatic approach, and he talked about it. I'm all things to all people. I'm not going to sweat the small stuff. I'm not going to quibble with Jews about their dietary laws. When I go evangelize Jews, I'll eat at their table. I'll observe their laws. I don't care. That's not the point. Let's keep our eyes on the big ball, which is the salvation, which is faith in Jesus Christ for our salvation. So when I'm around Greeks, I'll be like a Greek. When I'm around Jews, I'll be like a Jew. He was a Jew, as a matter of fact. Respectful to all. Don't compromise the gospel, but don't allow it to be an impediment to people's eternal salvation.
Finally, in this trip down memory lane with Trumpy Bear, we had to put him in this video so we could justify spending corporate money, $60 on a bear, by the way. It really does have a flag blanket as a cape, sort of. I'm not even sure exactly what it is. But there really is a flag blanket in there. This is a legitimate, you can give it, anybody can buy a Trumpy Bear on the street. Here at the Daily Caller, we went to the real thing. I think we got it on Amazon, if I'm not mistaken. But still, close enough to the real thing. It is the real, well, you got the tag right there. But, you know, China can duplicate anything these days. As it is the last show of the year, the video show. There'll be another video show next week, and there'll be podcasts every day, of course. But New Year's is coming up. You're going to be drinking. And I thought, well, we've got to incorporate alcohol into this show sometime in addition to our just natural state of being drunk. So we had author Michael Foley come in. His new book, Drinking with Saint Nick, is chock full of more than 100 recipes for drinks. Forget food. You can buy a recipe book for food any day of the week, or you can just throw some garlic on it, some salt and pepper, call it a day, and you're fine. When it comes to alcohol, that's where the real skill comes into play. And he taught us how to make something, and I'll be honest with you, every weekend since we filmed this episode about a month ago with Michael Foley, I have made the drink. I chose this clip because I've made this drink. The Turtle Dove Martini is awesome. It's great. It's very, very smooth. If you go watch the whole show, there's another drink recipe in there. And if you go buy the book, like I said, you got over 100. So if you're looking for a way to mix up New Year's Eve or make a big batch of something to impress your friends, this is the book for you. Without any further ado, I present Drinking and Michael Foley.
And we're back. Drinking with St. Nick. Michael Foley, drink number two. And there, how many recipes are in the book?
Oh, good question. I should know the answer to that. It's
ballpark it. Nobody's going to count and sue.
I know it's well over 100.
Oh, and excellent.
And that's not including the beer and wine suggestions that we also make.
Perfect. So we're going to show you two. We've already shown you one, the Burning Rosemary. This one is what?
This one's called the Turtle Dove Martini. One of the special sections of the book is that it not only has drinks for the 12 days of Christmas on the calendar between December 25th and January 6th, but it also has drinks for each of the verses of the carol, the 12 days of Christmas. So for the turtle dove,
there's a drink for everything.
There is indeed.
Festive. Eat, drink, and be merry. So what do we need for this one?
For this one, we
need the Turtle Dove Martini. We have our Drinking with the Saints martini glasses ready to go.
Exactly. So we've got amaretto, frangelico, a vanilla vodka, the only flavored vodka I approve of, and whole milk. And then nutmeg.
Frangelico is not something that's commonly used. What is frangelico?
Frangelico is a great
liqueur. It's dressed like a monk.
It's dressed like a monk.
I thought it was Mrs. Butterworth at first, but she doesn't wear a rope belt.
The rope cincture is the giveaway. This is a monastic belt. Because Frangelico was an Italian hermit who apparently invented this herbal liqueur. He grabbed things around his hermitage and made a liqueur out of it.
But you have a lot of time on your hands, and there's no television.
Exactly.
You can come up with amazing, amazing things, and thank God that those people did. Okay, so how do we go about making the turtle dove martini?
Okay, so you normally need 2 ounces of vanilla vodka, but I'm going to be pouring 4 because there are two of us.
There's a lot more of us. Everybody except for the person who's underage is excited about this.
And 2 ounces of Frangelico.
And you mix it together right there.
Yeah. So we're going to mix it all first and then shake it. And 1 ounce of amaretto. So I'm doubling that for us. And then 1.5 ounces.
Now, milk is where you get me confused. Milk, and this is... I just remembered Ron Burgundy drinking the milk. Milk was a bad choice. But it's a more common ingredient than most people, I think, realize in a lot of drinks.
It's true. And it's what gives the turtle dove martini its turtle dove appearance.
The doviness.
It actually does kind of look like a turtle dove by the time we're done.
Throw it in a shaker over ice.
Yep.
And then you shake this for about 40 seconds?
I shake it 40 times.
40 times.
Yeah, because that's a good biblical number of penance.
Is there a secret to shaking? And is there really a difference between shaken and stirred?
There is a difference between shaken and stirred. There are some drinks that you definitely want to shake and others you definitely want to stir.
Can you give an example of each?
Yes. You definitely want to shake anything that has an opaque liquid ingredient, like milk or lemon juice, because you need to really shake it to break up those flavors and make them do their thing. But the reason why you're not supposed to shake something like a martini, with all due respect to James Bond, is that when you shake gin is very sensitive. And when you
and
shake
it... I catch
it,
mine crying a lot.
Exactly, exactly. Fat. And when you shake gin, it gets bruised. And like many insecure people, when it's bruised, it grows bitter. So there is actually a bitter flavor to a shaken martini that doesn't exist with a stirred martini.
Try that at home. Try them both ways. I think it would be very interesting.
I was very skeptical of this to begin with.
It sounds weird.
It sounds weird.
That a liquid would taste different because you shook it.
And frankly, it sounded a little foofy, a little too sort of purist.
Right.
But we did a taste test at home, and it was a remarkable difference. So now I'm pro-stirred, whereas before I was not.
Okay, so we've got it in the shaker
with the
milk.
Exactly.
Give us 40 quick shakes.
All right.
All right. You get a close-up on that, Gio? He's actually counting. I should start counting, see if I can throw him off. But I wasn't counting to know if I threw him off or not. All right, so you got 40 quick shakes. That chills everything. It mixes it together.
Exactly.
It diffuses the milk.
And it's ready to go.
It carbonates it and causes it to explode.
Exactly. Here we are.
You pour it into a martini. Martini glass, why do martinis have their own glasses? These things, yeah. I've drank far too many martinis in my life, and these glasses just seem designed to spill.
It's true, but barware always has a purpose. And oh, thank you. And the purpose of the martini glass is to keep the heat of your hand away from the drink.
Because yeah, the martini warm is terrible.
It's a strained drink, so the ice has been removed because mm-hmm. you don't want it to water it down further, but you want it to stay cold.
What's the proper way to hold a martini glass? It's not like this.
No, no. So like a brandy snifter, you would hold like that because you want your hand to warm up the brandy. But with a martini glass, you want to keep it as far away, your hand as far away from the...
Like a delicate wine.
Exactly. Now, one last step. We got to add the nutmeg. This is actually what gives it a turtle dove appearance, because a turtle dove is a speckled dove.
You getting a shot of that, Guillaume? Oh, yeah. All right. It's a beautiful looking drink.
Well, thank you.
Cheers.
Cheers.
And this is the turtle dove martini. That's really good. And you poured a lot of different liquors in there.
That's right.
And it doesn't, your first sip of a martini is really usually one of the, there's none of that here. Is that the milk?
It's called a turtle dove martini, but of course it's not a true martini. It's a dessert drink.
You put vodka in there. Normally, you put a lot of vodka in there, actually, and everything else you put in there, with the exception of the milk, is liquor. It has alcohol in it, but there's no burn with
that.
Is that the milk doing that?
It's the milk, and the Frangelico is very sweet, and the Amaretto is sweet as well. So this is a great dessert drink.
I like this a lot. Kylie, come on and put your first drink down. Everybody's getting drunk on set today, ladies and gentlemen. Try that. Yeah, the thing is, the glass is ready to be spilled. It's like daring you to spill it.
That's really good. That's really good.
Yeah.
It's very, much like a dessert.
It's very smooth.
Creamy, yeah.
Now, Richard, resident Daily Caller alcoholic, come on in here and try this thing and then speak into my lapel.
I'm not an alcoholic. I just like alcohol.
Okay,
right?
That's the first sign of an alcoholic is not admitting it, but that's okay. You chug down half of it. You're not an alcoholic.
It tastes so good when it touches my lips.
Well, you just go away. I knew it would be a mistake to bring anybody who works here in on this. This is absolutely delicious. This one I will make at home. I appreciate you coming in.
Well, that was the year that was 2018. It wasn't actually. There was a lot more to it, but we can only do as much as we can do. Make sure you subscribe to the podcast. Every Friday there's a video edition, and the audio edition goes out on iTunes, on Stitcher, and SoundCloud. However you get your podcasts, it'll always be there. I want to thank Guillaume, Pierre-Louis, and Richard McGinnis. They are the video production team here, and they just admitted to me that I am by far the coolest person who comes in here and does videos. So that was very sweet of them. I'm by far the best in every way, I think is what you said, right?
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah, and science right there, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you for listening. Thank you, Trumpy Bear, for sitting in, guest hosting, co-hosting with me. That's right. Yeah, no, it's a serious thing. Trumpy Bear, fly. Thanks for listening. Thanks for watching. Click subscribe. Tell a friend. We'll see you back here on Monday with another edition of the Daily Caller podcast.